Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Roger Aronoff and Mal Klein for Take Aim, the new blog radio show by Accuracy and Media, and we are very happy to be with you again. This is our third week on the air, and this week we have two great guests. We have Cliff Kincaid, who is the editor of Accuracy and Media, and we have the author Noni Darwish. She will be on in the second half hour, and we are going to start right away here with our guest Cliff Kincaid. Cliff, are you there?
Hi, Roger.
Hi, how are you?
Doing good.
Well, great to have you on our show, and look forward to a lot of good things that we want to get into with you. So anyway, let's just give the people a little bit of a background. I mean, you've been with AIM for about 30 years now, I guess, and, you know, you worked with Reed longer than anybody, and just why don't you just tell us a little about your background and involvement with AIM, and then we'll get into some questions and some current topics.
Well, I was born in a log cabin, used to read by candle. No, I came to Washington, as you know, Roger, back in 1978 as an intern in the National Journalism Center run by Stan Evans. My outside internship as part of that program was at Accuracy and Media, and Reed hired me on a full-time basis, so he hired me out of college. I was a journalism major. I specialized in journalism and communications at the University of Toledo. Have been associated since 1978 in some capacity with AIM ever since, and of course have functioned as editor of the AIM report for several years now. And it really is interesting that we're talking, as we're scheduled to, about Walter Cronkite today, because AIM was really formed in part back in 1969 to counteract the misinformation and disinformation about the war in Vietnam that was emanating from the broadcasts of people like Walter Cronkite. And it's interesting, a fact of life, now that in our 40th anniversary year, we've been forced by circumstances, the passing of Walter Cronkite, to revisit this period and set the record straight about who exactly he was and what he did.
Okay, well, before we get started, I want to give a phone number out that people can call in if they have any questions, and we will put them on the air. And that phone number is 347-426-3984. That's 347-426-3984. So you brought up Walter Cronkite. Of course, he passed away last week and has been hailed by the media as an icon, the voice of God, all sorts of things. But there's obviously a lot more to the story than what we've been hearing on the mainstream media. And you've written a couple of great pieces on it. So tell us, what is your take on his career?
Well, on the one hand, it, of course, has to be acknowledged that Cronkite, who was the major voice in the media for many, many years, did capture and report on some important national and world events. So we've all seen the replays of the film footage of Cronkite getting choked up at announcing the death of President Kennedy. We've seen the film footage of him talking about the space program. Give him credit where credit is due. By circumstance, he was in a position to report on some electrifying events throughout American history. But by the same token, we have to look at the damage he did. And this gets back to the role of Reed Irvine, the founder of AIM, and the history of AIM, and how Reed engaged in many battles with CBS News, especially Walter Cronkite, and his misreporting of the Vietnam War, his deliberate campaign against building up America's national defenses. And then later in life, after he retired, Reed and I both wrote stories about how Cronkite really showed his true colors, going on the far left side of the political spectrum, speaking out against Presidents Reagan and Bush, and coming out in support of world government. So this was a man who had a lot of biases. The pretense, the myth is that he kept them all hidden while he was anchorman of the CBS Evening News. But Reed Irvine, during the time of Cronkite's reign, exposed that and set the record straight. And we've had to do the same in my columns that we released last week.
Cliff, Mal Klein, Accuracy in Academia. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Oh, great. Substituting for Don Irvine. Question, Cliff, since we're both in about the same age bracket, we grew up hearing Cronkite referred to as alternatively Uncle Walter and Mr. Believable, which I found tiresome even then, but that was me. Nevertheless, I haven't heard an anchor referred to that way since. Is there anybody there to match his stature that we had?
Well, some people are saying it's John Stewart. You know, what a turnaround, huh? A comic is now the most trusted man in America. But you know, you look back on it, Mal, and Cronkite had that reputation, in fact, because of the near monopoly that the evening news programs had over the news and information given to the American people. And with the CBS Evening News being the most prominent and having the most viewers. So he got that monocle, that label, by virtue of the fact that media choices were so limited back then. And I think it's a good thing that we will not have another most trusted man in America in the media. I mean, if people want to believe John Stewart, they can, but I don't. But the virtue of what's happened is that we don't have one man that we have to rely on, that we can pick and choose, that we can compare and contrast. We can go to a lot of different sources of information. And I should add that this is one fact that really irritates the left wing in the media today. I'll never forget George Clooney, who did the movie about Edward R. Murrow, talking about that after the fact and saying that he lamented the fact that we didn't have today a situation where there was one person, a Walter Cronkite, that people could turn to for the truth. Well, of course, we never got the truth from Cronkite in many cases on important issues like Vietnam, and that's a good thing. So Uncle Walter was not my uncle. I never trusted him, and Reed Irvine never did either.
Well, Cliff, one thing that you wrote about that I haven't seen anyone else write about is his career since he left CBS as the anchor, and that's been quite interesting and concerning too. Why don't you tell us about what Walter has done since he left his anchor position?
Of course, he retired in 1981, and then Dan Rather came aboard. But keep in mind, Roger and Mal, that Cronkite continued at CBS as a consultant. And this is why during the Reagan years, Cronkite would surface on some of these CBS News specials attacking the Reagan defense buildup. So he continued with CBS as a consultant. Then he started doing documentaries for the Discovery Channel, including one basically advocating the legalization of drugs. He got involved with a group, a George Soros-funded group called the Drug Policy Alliance. He showed up at an event sponsored by the left-wing People for the American Way, where he attacked President Reagan for bombing Libya and for liberating Grenada. Cronkite showed up as well for many years as a key figure in the World Federalist Movement. This is a group dedicated to world government. Cronkite, in fact, in his own book, I think it was called The Reporter's Notebook, I forget the exact title, but Cronkite comes right out and says, look, we need a world government. And he said this in public speeches. He favored all kinds of UN treaties to bring about a strengthening of the UN and an eventual world government. It was really quite extraordinary how far left he came out. But what was interesting is that he, to repeat, he had this bias all along. In fact, during one of his appearances back in 1999 at the World Federalist Association, he said before he went into journalism, he had been approached to become the public relations person or communications person for the World Federalist Movement. He decided, he said, to go into journalism, and of course he always claimed that he kept his biases out of his stories, but we know that's not true.
Mm-hmm. Well, Cliff, we want to move on to other topics, but one that you made a reference to are these UN treaties, and this is something that you have, again, been in the forefront of writing about, and just want to tell our audience that you can read all of these articles at our website, aim.org, and you can go on there and search for any of this, or you'll find a lot of things right on the front page or in the news part of it. But so tell us, there's a number of UN treaties that are out there that have been out there for quite a while that haven't made much headway, but now that President Obama is in office, I think there might be more reason for concern. Tell us about some of these treaties and where does all this stand and which are your biggest concerns?
It's important to realize treaties are an important part from the perspective of people like Walter Cronkite of bringing about world government through a strengthening of the United Nations system because these treaties help integrate the United States into this concept that's called international law. We've always had treaties. Treaties are alluded to and mentioned in the U.S. Constitution, but they were envisioned by our founding fathers as documents that were supposed to be between nations, that were designed to enable the country to facilitate certain agreements on trade. But the kinds of treaties we're talking about now are all-encompassing UN universal treaties that affect almost every aspect of our lives. And many of these treaties dealing with women's rights and children's rights and so forth have been lying around for literally years, some decades, and have been on the back burner because conservatives have voiced a very deep concern about them. But with Obama, we're seeing how he's starting to move forward here to get many of them ratified. He's already submitted a document to the Foreign Relations Committee saying he wants 17 different treaties ratified. Some of them, such as the Law of the Sea Treaty, have been around for many, many years, and in fact that one was pushed by the Bush administration. But what we saw this campaign begin actually on Friday, when not a lot of people were paying attention, when Obama held a White House ceremony to announce that he would have Susan Rice, his UN ambassador, sign this treaty on the rights of disabled persons. In fact, Susan Rice is going to sign that treaty tomorrow. There's going to be another White House event. And this is one of these treaties. It's very interesting that he picked this one to begin this treaty barrage because this one, at least on the surface, sounds non-controversial. I mean, who can be against protecting the rights of disabled persons? But when you analyze it, as I did in a column the other day, you'll find that it's really unnecessary from our perspective because we've had the Americans with Disabilities Act on the books for 19 years. Moreover, when you analyze the actual language of the treaty, it doesn't protect the rights of certain disabled persons, such as the innocent unborn who have a defect such as Down syndrome. And in fact, this treaty, when you analyze it, has a provision, a pro-abortion provision, affirming an international right to abortion. So in my view, this is a subterfuge. It's a disguise. It's a clever attempt by Obama to, in the name of protecting disability rights, get abortion enshrined as a global but also national right. And this would be unprecedented in world history and especially in American history.
Cliff, speaking of treaties, when we both covered the hearing, I think it was the last hearing on the UN Law of the Sea Treaty, all the so-called mainstream media were there, AP, New York Times, Washington Post, etc. And the only stories to come out of that hearing were yours and mine.
Well, that's
like
right. Yeah. It's true. And this is one reason why I've focused on the UN problem for so long, is I saw the same thing, Mal, years and years ago. And that's why back in 1995, I wrote a book on the UN called Global Bondage.
Yep.
And then 2 years later, I wrote a book called Global Taxes for World Government. That was in 1997. I saw this happening back then. In fact, one of the things that really got my attention was a 1994 report by the UN Development Program, where they had an article in the report by economist Jan Tinbergen in which he called for world government and said the world government will arrive through a strengthening of the United Nations system, in part by passing all these treaties. So, you know, that got my attention, and I knew at the time and recognized at the time that the media were really not paying attention to what was happening globally. And now, of course, it's becoming more of an issue because so many things have been happening globally. The UN has acquired more power and influence, and even Henry Kissinger has commented earlier this year that he thinks Obama is going to usher in the so-called New World Order. So more and more people are paying attention. Our efforts are being fruitful in that more and more conservatives are starting to become aware of these global treaties and the increasing power of these world institutions and organizations.
Well, these treaties all have such nice sounding names, against all discrimination against women and for children, and then like the Law of the Sea Treaty. I mean, who could object to there being orderly process that governs the seas of the world? What is the problems generally with these? Why what we hear on the surface isn't really what would happen if these got enacted? And is there any way that these can be in America's interests?
Well, I mean, you think about it, this is the whole agenda of the UN. You look at the term United Nations. I mean, that sounds good too. But you look at the record, and you don't have to go through the last several decades, but this is an organization that, in my view, by any objective standard, has made world problems worse, not better. The United Nations, again, formed after the end of World War II, supposedly to bring the nations of the world together, to act together, and what do we learn about it? We learn that the original founder, the first acting Secretary General, State Department official Alger Hiss, turned out to be a Soviet spy. So from the start, this has been a flawed institution. Yeah, there's some things that they can do, they can help with, but these treaties frequently are undermined by the language. They don't work out in practice. They hurt American interest. In terms of the Law of the Sea Treaty, this is an effort to mask over the fact that our Navy has shrunk by almost half from the days of President Reagan when he was pursuing a 600-ship Navy. Now we're down to about 280. And the belief, and I've heard State Department officials say this, they believe somehow that a piece of paper called the Law of the Sea Treaty will protect our interests on the high seas and protect our access to the resources of the oceans. Well, how will a UN treaty and turning over these matters to foreign judges and international tribunals do that? In the ultimate analysis, the only thing that guarantees your rights as a nation consists of your military power. And the fact is that we're falling behind. We're not very strong in terms of our Navy. And so it's really a diversion. The UN is a false hope. It's put out there as some kind of substitute for doing what really has to be done to protect America's interests.
Hey, Cliff, speaking of unholy alliances, the Catholic Church that we both belong to for several thousand years has embraced the principle of subsidiarity. That is, where you need government, that level that's closest to the problem is the one that should handle it. But now you've shown in your articles that the Pope seems to have embraced the concept of world government. What gives?
Well, this is very troubling to me. We all know that there are different currents, there are different elements in the Catholic Church, just like there are in any religion, any denomination, really. There are conservative and liberal elements, and yet we saw in this recent encyclical from Pope Benedict that he endorsed explicitly the creation of what was called a world political authority. There can be no other explanation of that than that he believes in some kind of world government, or at least he believes it is coming and he wants to have some role in it. This is a matter of controversy and dispute, but nevertheless, this is what was in the encyclical. The fact is that Catholics and non-Catholics alike have to admit it's there and try to explain it, try to understand it, but not ignore it. And this is what has bothered me about some of the so-called Catholic conservative academics out there who have said, well, it's not really the most important thing there, because they emphasize, as you suggested earlier, Mal, this principle of local control, that this is what really the Pope believes in. But you cannot reconcile that the Catholic principle of local control with a world political authority. And this is why this contradiction has to be addressed and explained.
So, Cliff, you have written about some of Obama's appointments. Now, he originally named some people like Robert Gates and then Ray LaHood, some Republicans, to his administration to kind of make some people, the moderates and conservatives, feel that he was being inclusive. But at the same time, he has appointed some pretty radical people, and you've written about them. Tell us about a couple of the ones that we should be most concerned about.
Well, before getting to that, I would argue that Gates has proven to be a major disappointment and basically a hatchet man for massive defense cuts. He's the guy who's been leading the charge for cutting off funding of the F-22. This is a fifth-generation fighter, tremendous aircraft that would guarantee American air superiority probably for many, many years to come, and yet he wants taking orders from Obama, he wants to cut that off at 189 planes. That continues to be a big issue on Capitol Hill. But as bad as Gates has been, I think he's basically a patriot. He wants to keep America strong. And we've got these other characters Obama's put in, like Harold Coe at the State Department. He's the top legal advisor, or his science advisor, John Holdren, who are openly committed to world government. Again, we get back to this recurring theme we've talked about today. These are, you might read some of the things these people say, like this guy John Holdren, who talks about a planetary regime managing the world. Your temptation is to say, well, these people are crackpots. These people are nuts. But no, they're in positions of power in places like the White House and the State Department. And so this is why I write about them and why we've focused in on them, because, the old saying goes, personnel make policy. And I believe that as bad as their views are and as shocking as their views are, they reflect the person who named and appointed them.
Hey, Cliff, we should point out that you are actually one of the few journalists who does question authority no matter which political party is in power. And following from that, you're one of the few who has not just parroted the Obama line in reporting on what's happening in Honduras. What is exactly going on there as we speak?
This is very troubling. I've devoted a lot of time and attention to this. And consequently, we've been hearing from a lot of people in Honduras who are thanking us and who are wanting us to continue to get the truth out. But what has happened down there, according to the Obama administration, which has been orchestrating the news coverage from the start, is that the a horrible military regime has taken power through a coup d'etat. And, you know, this is reminiscent of the bad old days of Latin America, and it cannot stand, and we have to work to restore democracy. Of course, what is really happening is that they had a president who had been democratically elected, a guy named Mel Zelaya, who was violating the law and the Constitution to try to keep himself in power, sort of like the way Hugo Chavez is manipulating the process in Venezuela. But in this case, in the case of Honduras, all the other branches of government, including the Supreme Court and the Congress, said no. And using their own democratic processes, they got rid of Zelaya. They ordered the military to go in and arrest him, and they deported him. And, of course, he's been trying to get back into power ever since on the backs of the Obama administration, the Hugo Chavez regime in Venezuela, the Organization of American States, the United Nations. And so Honduras has been cut off from a lot of foreign aid, has been isolated, and the people are desperate. They're struggling, and they want the truth out about what really happened down there. And so I've just been trying to get out the facts and hope that we can somehow get through not only to the rest of the media, but to the Congress and you know, I doubt if we can ever get through to Obama, but maybe the State Department. I think there are indications that State Department Secretary of State Hillary Clinton may be having second thoughts about the mess they've gotten into in Honduras, because if they follow through on their announced policy of restoring this guy Zelaya to power, they will put back into power this Hugo Chavez wannabe. And the only beneficiaries of that will be Chavez and his backers, including those in Iran who have been dealing with him for many years. So this is a very, very serious matter. It's a small country, only 7 million people. But Honduras should not be treated this way. We should be more understanding. It's a longtime friend of the United States. The people are pro-American. They've got a mixed free enterprise economy. We should be working with them, not trying to isolate them and destroy their democratic form of government. You know, we can disagree about whether Zelaya should have been deported or whether he should have been tried or this or that, but you know, there are some details about what happened that have to be cleared up and can be debated. But the bottom line is that we should be supporting this new government, not trying to destroy it.
Cliff, we're going to have to wrap it up, but I just wanted to give you a chance to tell us anything else going on. I know you have your other organization and you have something coming up. Why don't you tell us briefly about that? And then just want to remind listeners that you can sign up for our daily email at aim.org and read all of Cliff's articles. And so why don't you give us your final thoughts and tell us what you want us to know about your other group and what you've got coming up there, Cliff.
Well, before I came back to AIM on a full-time basis as editor of the AIM Report, I had started a group about 10 years ago called America Survival to focus in on some of these UN issues we've been talking about. We were one of the first groups to issue a warning about the International Criminal Court, for example. This was 10 years ago. Now it's a reality. Now it's expanding its reach, scope around the country. But we deal with a lot of issues, including communism and communism in education. And if you go to our website, you'll find we have a conference coming up on August 20th at the National Press Club. I won't go into any more detail now. It's all there, but we're going to focus in on Bill Ayers, the Obama associate who is now a, quote, distinguished professor. So you can get more information about that, Roger and Mal, at usasurvival.org. That's usasurvival.org.
Cliff, thank you so much for taking the time, and it's been a great half hour, and we'll talk to you soon.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Next, we're going to get right into our second guest, Noni Darwish. Are you there, Noni?
Yeah, good morning.
Hi, I'm Roger Aronoff, and I'm on with Mal Klein as the co-host here today.
Welcome.
And we're excited to have you on here for this next half hour.
My pleasure, Roger and Mal.
So you're out in California, right?
Yeah, I'm in Los Angeles.
Okay. Well, you have an outstanding new book out. It's your second book called Cruel and Usual Punishment. And Noni has been writing and lecturing she's been on Fox, on MSNBC, on NPR, on Al Arabiya, CNN. Their articles have been published all over the world. She's a frequent lecturer. And so we just want to get right into this. Tell us about you and how you came to be writing a book like Cruel and Usual Punishment.
The reason I'm writing it is to alert the West that Islam is encroaching bit by bit. It's already accepted Islamic law in Great Britain as a religious right to Muslims. And I hear a lot of mosques in America that are demanding Sharia. There are some Muslim groups who are telling Americans that Islamic law is it can be accommodated in the United States, and that it is just a religious right. But I wanted to tell Americans it is not a religious right.
Well, what is your background? Where are you from? Tell us a little about.
Sure. I was born and raised as a Muslim in Cairo, Egypt. I also grew up in the Gaza Strip, and that was during the 50s. As a child, my father headed the Egyptian military intelligence in Gaza, and he was a high-ranking officer. And Egypt at that time, the president of Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser, wanted to throw the Jews in the sea. And my father was assassinated by Israel because of the Fida'iyin operations against Israel. Fida'iyin means it's a kind of a guerrilla-style warfare, and Israel was suffering. And my father was killed. After that, I moved back to Cairo. But I grew up in an atmosphere of the Arab-Israeli conflict, right in the middle of it. And lost my father to the jihad against Israel. And jihad is a requirement from every Muslim to do jihad. The definition of jihad, according to Muslim law, is to war with non-Muslims to establish the religion. And there is a lot of deception going on in the West, where some Muslims are trying to tell the West that jihad does not permit violence, which is not true. 97% of the world in the Quran, when the jihad is mentioned, it refers to war and conflict and killing, subjugating. Only 3% of the time it does not refer to killing. So there is a lot of misinformation given to the American public about the jihad and Islam's intentions in the West.
So you've defined jihad for us. What about Sharia law? Tell us what that is and why we should be concerned.
About 150 years after Muhammad died, he just left the Quran to the people. What happened is there were many people leaving Islam after Muhammad died. And so the Muslim leaders at that time could not control the people with just the Quran. So what they did is they came up with a lot of sayings of Muhammad and the Quran, his lifestyle, how he lived, and they created something called Sharia, which is a religious law that is inspired by the lifestyle and words of Muhammad. And it was designed to be a total control of the Muslim citizen. It is the most oppressive law ever created on earth. And I'll give you the words of the most, one of the most prominent Muslims in the 20th century, Sheikh Maududi. He described the Islamic State ruled under Sharia, and he said that it seeks to mold every aspect of life and activity in such a state. No one can regard any field of his affairs as personal or private. No private life. Everything must be controlled by the Islamic State. And he compared that state, the Muslim state, that it bears a kind of resemblance to the fascist and communist state. He admitted that the Islamic State is a totalitarian system, and he was never challenged by any other Muslim group or leaders. So this is the truth about the Sharia, Islamic law. It is not religion, because a religion is a relationship with God, but Sharia law is a very elaborate legal system that can only be practiced by a totalitarian regime, and it can put you to death if you leave it, just like communism. If you jump the Berlin Wall, you get shot at. In Islam, if you leave Islam, you must be killed. All the four schools of Sharia say the same thing. Anyone who dares to leave Islam must be killed. It's a tyranny, and they want to bring this to the West. It is totally in conflict with our Bill of Rights and with our Constitution and with the Judeo-Christian society that we live in.
Wow.
I am now a Christian, thank God. But
I'm sorry, ma'am. Thank you so much for joining us. It's an honor to have you with us. I've got to ask, the California State Board of Education is crafting its own definition of Sharia to teach to seventh graders, in which they say, quote, unquote, Sharia or Islamic law, quote, this is where the quote begins, rejected the older Arabian view of women as family property, declaring that women and men are entitled to respect and moral self-governance, end of quote. How accurate a depiction is that?
This is dictated directly from the Saudi Arabian government to the schools of America via donations and pleasing the far left in America. This is total distortion of what Sharia really is, and Americans are falling for it. I believe that the teachers' unions in America have sold their objectivity for supporting the Saudi propaganda in America. That same propaganda played on all Muslim countries around Saudi Arabia. In the 7th century, the Arabian Peninsula tribes went out and conquered the two superpowers of the 7th century, Egypt and Persia. Egypt and Persia were weak at that time because they were fighting each other a lot, morally and spiritually. And the people didn't like their government. And when the Arabs came in, they said the same thing. Islam is a peace, and that's how they fooled the people who didn't speak Arabic. And that's how they go into a country, by completely misleading the people about the religion. But I hope that in the 21st century, with all the Islamic literature translated, that we wake up in America and don't fall to this kind of propaganda that is dictated by the most dictatorial and evil system on earth, which is the Saudi system. Look how they treat their women. They stone them to death. There is a, if they have any sexual crime, they, even rape is considered a sexual crime for a woman. There is, America must wake up, because the teachers' union and some far left groups in America are really, they don't even know what they're bringing into the American public. They have no clue. It's irresponsible. I am shocked. I didn't know that they were teaching what Sharia means. And it's very sad. It's very sad that I hear that, because they cannot take the words of Saudi Arabia. This is the misleading and total lies. Actually, Islam came to preserve the and make it even worse. Women had more rights before Islam came in Arabia. And yes, there was a lot of oppression of women, but they preserved the oppression. Did you know that Islam, until today, never, never abolished slavery? Slavery is in the Sharia books. And they are teaching it as something good. In the Sharia books, women are called inferior and have a shortage of brain and religion. And they must abide by their husband, or else they get no support. They are slaves in their home. There are laws that called obedience laws for a woman. That if a woman is not totally obedient, and she must have permission from her husband to leave the house, she can be practically imprisoned in the house. And the, our teachers' union are teaching, they are promoting a system of tyranny in a country that gave women the rights. Are we going backwards? It is sad for me to hear that.
Well, ma'am, if I may, I just want to read you the other thing that the California standards, which are available online, by the way, and we link to them at www.campusreportonline.net. But the other thing they say is that in the 7th century, here's a direct quote, Muslim merchants came to operate from China to the Mediterranean, their trade facilitated by shared acceptance of Sharia law, period, end quote. How is this shared acceptance achieved?
There was no shared acceptance by the public. It was sold to dictators across the whole area, because it gave leaders the absolute power and blame God for it. If people, you know, complain from the tyranny of Sharia, then they will say this is Allah's law. Can you please repeat the website where I can read this?
www.campusreportonline.net.
That's outrageous.
Yeah. So
Noni, what are the best examples and indications that Sharia might be coming to this country? Where do you see areas that we should be concerned about?
Well, they are trying to go to the educational system in America. That's where the money of the Gulf and Saudi Arabia and oil-rich country. It's going to our educational institutions. And this is where they are brainwashing the children in America, because they don't want to go and convince the older people. Their plan is a long-term plan. It is to bring Islam incrementally. And they must convince the students and the young people in America to be ashamed to criticize Sharia, to be ashamed to say our system is better than their system, and it gives women the rights. I mean, under Sharia law, a man can beat up his wife. It's allowed. And he doesn't even have to say to the police why, or to her family, or even to the woman. You can beat your wife. In America, if a woman is abused physically, she can call the police for rescue. In the Muslim world, she cannot call the police for rescue. And they are penetrating our educational system. And I didn't know that this went all the way to public schools. I thought this was more in universities. But I do know that teachers' unions are giving credit, teachers' credit, if they go and learn about Islam and tolerance in Islam. This is becoming really prevalent, and they get teachers credit by attending a seminar to brainwash them that Islam is a religion of peace and the Sharia is a great legal system. This is in America.
Wow. I've got to ask, now you say that most Muslim countries follow a liberal version of Sharia. How liberal is the liberal version of Sharia?
No, there is no liberal version of Sharia. What I said is that governments, Muslim governments, apply Sharia at different levels.
Okay.
Some of them are 100%, like Saudi Arabia and Iran, and the Taliban, some places in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And some countries like Egypt apply it, let's say, 60-70%, which means they do not cut the arms and the limbs of thieves, which is Sharia law. Sharia law is you steal, you get your arm cut. And I can't believe that they are trying to say to convince Americans that this is a good legal system. It's the total tyranny. And what happens is the brilliance of the people who created Sharia in the 8th century, it started, the late 7th century, 8th century, because it didn't come with Muhammad. Muhammad, they created it about 100 years after Muhammad died to control the people. And not let them leave Islam, and made the penalty for leaving Islam death. And what happened is the Sharia, even though it doesn't apply 100% in some countries, but they allowed 3 murders under Sharia to be practiced on the street without punishment. Vigilante street justice is allowed under Sharia. Are we going to allow this in America? And you know what these murders are? Killing an apostate. Killing somebody who leaves Islam is okay by a fellow Muslim on the street, and they will get away with it.
So let me ask you, outside of the university, we've heard the term recently of Sharia-compliant finance. So
yes.
Where else is it coming into play in our society? And tell us a little about that and how that is happening.
Well, under Islamic law also, interest is not allowed by banks. So Muslim countries are starting to create their own banks in the West. Mind you, these same countries do not allow any kind of, they don't allow the West to practice their religion in Muslim countries. So it's a one-way system of penetration. So that banking system rewards countries that practice Sharia and punishes countries that do not financially, that do not practice Sharia. So they are coming to you from every side, from every angle, to enforce the Sharia on us. And I am puzzled as to, I must write an article, thank you for telling me this, that this is an outrageous thing that's happening in our teachers, you know, and then they go in and teach our young kids, our American kids, that Sharia is just as good as apple pie and the American flag. And then these same kids are shamed from asking questions, because if they ask questions, then they are attacking a religion. And that is not a religion. It's a very tyrannical legal system that can put you to death if you leave it. It allows wife beating. It allows it. Do you know that under Islamic law, a Muslim head of state can come to hold office through seizure of power? Which means through a coup d'etat, through the assassination of the previous president. It does not say through election. There is no election of the population. So this is totally, it's obligatory to obey the commandments of the Muslim head of state, even if he's unjust.
Hey, Mel. I should point out that the state of California does have a 60-day comment period where they're taking comments that ends in the middle of September. We have the address for where to send comments.
Yes, please. Can I have the address?
Yes, it's on the website. We have it on a couple of articles, you know, but I will get you actually.
Maybe after the program, if somebody can give me the information,
the
I would really appreciate it. I need to have all this information.
Absolutely. I have to ask, how are you able to move around in the Muslim community after the books you've written and the speeches you've given?
Well, the Muslim community in America, the true Muslim community in America, the ones that are loyal to the Saudi Arabia and the Muslim Brotherhood, I don't want to befriend them, and they don't want to befriend me. But there are many good and peace-loving Muslims in America, and they are good and peace-loving not because of the Islamic teaching, by the way. It's because of the human nature. And those we get along, but I cannot. There is a lot of see, the West is behind the curve. In the Muslim world right now, there is a lot of soul searching. There is a lot of change going on. Just a few days ago, a very top Muslim woman in Egypt, and she is a graduate from Al-Azhar University, a specialist in Sharia. She's an attorney, and she left Islam, and she said, I'm not going to be scared. I'm going to be exposing all of these lies right in Egypt. She's going back. She's there, and she's subjecting her life to death. She will be killed. And I'm very worried for her. So there are many brave people who are doing the right thing from the Muslim world. And here we are in America burying the truth for the sake of political correctness.
Noni, we're going to have to wrap it up here in a minute. But tell us about, there's a lot of tension
of attention given to President Obama's speech from Cairo, and it was said to send out a sort of moderate tone to these Arab and Muslim nations. Give us your take on the speech and how it was taken, how it was sort of interpreted in the media. We really need to kind of wrap this up in about 2 minutes, but
yeah.
So try
well,
to do
it. He is trying to appease the Muslim world by glorifying Islam and spreading the same misinformation. He probably doesn't know Islam properly himself. And unfortunately, he became quite popular in Egypt and in many Muslim countries. But he is making Obama popular, not America popular. They love him. They hate America because it's an infidel country. They have their eyes on America to convert it to Islam. And there is a leader who comes and tells them, I'm going to force some laws to protect hate speech against Islam in America. Here he is saying, I want to give you the right to do zakat, to pay your alms in America. He doesn't even have an idea that part of the zakat must go towards jihad. Part of the money that Muslims spend for zakat, which is giving money away, is to promote the jihad, which means promoting the 9/11, the people who do 9/11. It is the ignorance of the American people of the truth is enormous. Because
you're doing a great job, Noni, in helping to clear up a lot of these questions and to help Americans understand and prepare and beware. And so I want to tell them again, your book, Cruel and Usual Punishment, Noni Darwish, that's Darwish. And where can they find the book?
At Amazon, in all bookstores.
Okay. And do you have a website?
Yes, ArabsForIsrael.com and NoniDarwish.com.
Great. Well, listen, thank you so much for being on here with us, and we look forward. We hope a lot of people will read your book as a result of this and become more aware of this situation, and thank you so much for being
thank
with
you,
us
Thank you, and
today.
I hope you can email me the information on
we
on this, because I really
that.
Need
I
to answer
certainly
it.
Will.
Thank you so much. God bless you.
Thank you.
You. Bye.
Okay, folks. Well, listen, Mal and I are wrapping up here. We've got just a few seconds to go, but I just want to thank you, tell you that in 2 weeks from today, we have Michelle Malkin as a special guest on this show. And also to point out, this is AIM's 40th anniversary year, and in October on the 23rd, we're going to be having a big event here in Washington. So if you're in this area, it would be great to see you there, and we're going to have a lot of great speakers and panels. So in the meantime, visit our website, aim.org, and sign up for our daily emails and tune in on Thursdays at 11 to our show. Mal, thanks for being the co-host here today.
Thank you.
You bet. And we're signing off, everybody. Till next week.
Bye-bye.